meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. If you remember, a few weeks back, I had the former Palestinian terrorist, Waleed Shobat, on the program. And I wanted to continue on with that type of programming. And I know Joel Brodsky. I've had Joel Brodsky on the program several times. You know, Joel is a Chicago-based lawyer. And his partner, Reem Odeh, and he do immigration law and criminal law. Well, the war in Gaza, as we've talked about many times on this program here and covered the best that we can, has hit home for these two Chicago lawyers. Reem Odeh is a Palestinian-American, and Joel Brodsky is Jewish. And the other day, Joel Brodsky gets an email from Reem saying that one of their clients' family has been killed in a airstrike in Gaza. That client is Moshe Sella, and his brother, sister-in-law, five nieces and nephews were killed in an Israeli airstrike. And if you can get any more tragic than that, you know, come see me, because I don't think that you can. This conflict is being escalated from the Jewish side, from the Israeli side. I find it fascinating that the client Motion is in the United States working on an immigration issue, wants to be a United States citizen. And I just think it's so tragic to see that his family is taken this way. But there's also a bigger side to this whole story. So I thought I'd bring on Reem Odeh and Motion to talk tonight about this. And first of all, I want to start with Motion. My sincere condolences to you and your family for your loss, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Reem Odeh, Joel Brodsky, if anything, is a interesting, well-versed lawyer who's been very high profile with high profile cases, and a lot of people don't know about the partnership that you have with him and what your law firm does. Tell us a little bit about you, Joel, and your law firm, and then we'll get into the story.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me on your show. I am an American citizen born here in the United States. I am also Palestinian. Both of my parents immigrated to the United States from the West Bank territories of Palestine. Joel Brodsky and I have been business partners in the law firm for about 5 years, and he's also Jewish American. We practice primarily, heavily concentrated in criminal defense. We do a lot of immigration work as well. So that's just a little bit of our background.
Motion, what brought you to the United States?
Well, I came here almost 8 years ago with the hope of continuing my education, get my master's degree and my PhD degree, and have a better life, actually, to be able to help myself and help my family back home.
This conflict is, and I'm talking about the conflict in Gaza right now, it's not new, it's been going on for some time. To see it reported in the United States, across the world, the way that it's reported, different slants, different ways of reporting it, to see the Hamas issue brought up, to see all that. And I'm going to take you back before your family was tragically taken. How did you feel about that? Is that one of the reasons why you came to the United States, or did you find the United States more opportunistic for you?
Well, I don't think any Palestinian would leave his territory or his land over the issue of the conflict with Israel. A lot of people think so, but it's not the point here. I came here for my personal interest, not to escape from my territory or from my country. Hamas was not exist at the time when it came 8 years ago. I mean, they were exist, but they were not in power.
Right.
So.
And that issue, a lot of people don't understand, Reem, because of the way that the story is reported in the broadcast media. This looks like something that this particular issue has been this issue for a long time, but there are different aspects. You also, as a Palestinian American, your thoughts on the conflict?
Well, I mean, I grew up hearing the stories from my parents and family and friends on the Israeli occupation. I never experienced it myself, other than for when I do visit family back in the West Bank. But, you know, Palestine is an occupied territory. And in my perspective and from what I've been able to witness, you know, Israel has continued to commit very horrible crimes against Palestinians. And I don't see what the difference between acts of terrorism and acts that Israeli government has committed against Palestinians in general. As far as Hamas is concerned, they were elected a few years ago by the people. They continue to become more popular amongst the Palestinians. They're more of a grassroots sort of organization that was formed. And, you know, basically don't recognize the right of the State of Israel to exist.
Motion, with the recent elections, and now Benjamin Netanyahu being reelected, a lot of people say that all that will do is just increase the conflict, make the conflict worse. Your thoughts?
I don't think so. Actually, there's no difference in my own experience. I lived basically almost my life there. And they went through, like, from government to other. They're basically the same thing. It's just different caption, different title, different name. What they do, basically all of them, is the same against Palestinians.
When a client comes to you, Reem Odeh, from the firm of Brodsky and Odeh in Chicago, and an immigration issue, wants to come to the United States, and a lot of people, again, don't understand that. We hear so much about illegal immigration, about the Mexican component and crossing the border illegally and all that sort of stuff, but we don't hear much, again, in the media, and shame on them, about how if someone wants to come to the United States, like your client Motion, to better themselves or to further their education or whatever, what they're supposed to do, how they do it. How do you handle a case like this? And we're going to get into the tragedy somewhat here in a bit and how it's affected your law firm, but let's talk about legal immigration.
Mm-hmm. Well, immigration is a very broad area, and there's so many different ways of coming to the United States. For instance, if someone is in another country and seeks to come to the United States, there are many different types of visas that are available to them. However, there are quotas, and there are a certain number of visas for each category that are allotted by the United States State Department each year. So, for instance, if a student in a foreign country wants to come to study in the United States, you would apply for a student visa and apply with a school here. And then there's also a visitor visa, and that would just entail going to the U.S. Embassy and applying as a visitor and then having to come an overwhelming burden of proof to prove to the United States that government that you are going to come back to your country after a certain specific period of time. So sometimes visitor visas are given for about 6 months. And then there's always family-based visa petitions. Also, someone who wants to petition for a family member or a spouse can do so as well. But we also have the ones that are here in the United States who have come to the U.S. on either a visitor visa or a student visa. And sometimes, for many people, their only way of obtaining a visa from the U.S. Embassy, sometimes you know, they make misrepresentations, or they tell the U.S. Embassy that they want to come here to study. Once they arrive here, a lot of times certain people, depending on where they're from, will ask for political asylum, and then they have to go through an asylum hearing, the asylum process. And those are people that are fearful of returning to their home country, fearful of being persecuted by their government. For many Palestinians, a lot of them that do apply for asylum, their claim is based on the fact of severe economic restriction, and that's also been declared as a form of persecution.
Motion, and I think Reem segued into that question for me. The process for you, how has it been trying to go through the immigration process in the United States?
Well, I think I'm just going up through a normal process here. I actually applied through like a family petition. Mm-hmm. My wife applied for me. She's an American citizen.
Okay.
I'm married to an American citizen here. We've been married for a little bit over 2 years now. And I don't think, I'm not applying for asylum or anything like this. So I think my case should be smooth and should be going all right.
Are you being treated fairly?
Well, I don't think so. I want to have Ms. Reem explain that to you.
Okay. From what I understand, Reem, is that there have been some questions as far as fairness goes. I'm not sure if it's a stigma with a hearing officer or just flat-out racism. And I'm using those terms. You're not. Has your client been treated fairly?
Well, I think you said it, a little bit of both. There is a stigma attached to certain individuals from specific countries, and there is some racial profiling done quite often with regards to immigration officers, and a lot of them are not as educated on certain issues as I think they should be. As far as Mr. Saha is concerned, he is married to a U.S. citizen. He is eligible to immediately adjust to become a permanent resident based on his marriage to his wife. However, as an Arab male from Gaza, he faces some obstacles when dealing with his immigration. A lot of question marks arise, some suspicions always out there that maybe a certain individual is petitioning for someone just solely for the purpose of, you know, circumventing immigration laws. But in Mr. Salha's case, that is absolutely not the case at all. And he's married to his wife. It's a bona fide marriage. However, I do think that a lot of the his officer in particular, I wasn't at the interview. Mr. Bratz handled the interview. In fact, I was actually in the West Bank visiting with family members at the time that his interview was scheduled. However, from what I understood is that at the beginning of the interview, there was some hostility, and it wasn't a very amicable experience initially. But then later on the interview, Mr. Brodsky did take control of the interview, and then it was fine from there. So I don't think he's going to have a problem whatsoever.
That's great to hear. Motion, let's talk about culture. Obviously, coming to the United States, there's a... I'm going to use the term culture shock, and maybe that's not a fair term to use, but you have to get used to, and again, that term stigma, some racism, you know, it can't be all attributed to 9/11, because there was that sort of stigma and racism going on even before 9/11, but 9/11 certainly didn't help, you know, an individual like yourself or your family, where people who don't understand or who are just plain ignorant strike out against you. How has it been for you with the culture change?
Well, it's actually a huge change between there and here. And in a way, September 11 actually did work fine with us. Basically, the fact a lot of American people like tried to educate themselves and to get to know the truth, and they asked a lot of questions about what's going on. Yeah, in the beginning, in the first impression, they were like linked or joined like Muslim with terrorists. If you're Arab, if you're a Palestinian or Muslim in general, they would just accuse you of being a terrorist, like without just period.
Right.
So that incident, or that what happened on September 11th, gave us a chance as Arab American or Arab or Muslim in America to explain ourselves and to talk to people. And that actually worked very, very, very good, actually.
Reem, as a Palestinian American, your partner Joel Brodsky, Jewish, this tragedy, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but it is part of the story, obviously. Has it caused any strife between you? I know you're both big freedom of political expression, freedom of speech people. We all are. That's one of the indelible rights that we have here in North America. But how has it affected your partnership with Joel?
Well, are you talking about how has September 11th affected our partnership?
Well, let's go through everything, right from September 11th right to the tragedy where Motion's family all died in the airstrike.
You know, actually, I think it has strengthened our partnership, and it has brought out the better in both of us, and we've been able to have a lot more dialogue. It's given us an opportunity to hear each other's perspective, learn where each other are coming from. Joel has been great in assisting a lot of our clients, and also a lot of our clients have also been faced with a lot of interrogations, a lot of unnecessary interrogations by, you know, for example, the FBI or Joint Terrorism Task Force or different agencies of the federal government. And Joel's been very helpful, and it's been an opportunity for us to have one-on-one dialogue with some of these agencies and be able to explain about the Arab and Muslim culture. So I think it's been actually just things have been more positive around the office. That's the only effect that I can see.
That is good to hear, because a lot of people just don't realize, and it could have easily turned south for both of you because of your beliefs. But it's the being able to sit down and discuss it is just so important. Motion, I don't want to dwell too much on your tragedy, but I would like to ask you, you know, your brother, sister-in-law, five nieces and nephews, all of a sudden one push of a button from an Israeli jet and they're all gone. Your thoughts?
Well, this is not the first time we get hurt, actually. Before my father passed a few years ago, every single time we sit and talk about it, and he cries and he tells me how they got deported in 1948 and how other family members got killed and arrested and so on and on and on, like all the years before that. This is not the first time, and we are not the only people who got hurt. So many Palestinians suffer for many years. And this, like, now they're accusing Hamas of causing this, and I don't think Hamas is the reason for killing 1,300 Palestinians in Gaza and injured over, like, 5,000. The problem here is, if you want to say Hamas is the reason for doing that, where Hamas was in 1948,
right,
when they occupied Palestine and deported our grandparents and... Now, I was born and raised in a refugee camp. What's my fault? What did I commit? What kind of crime I did in my life to be born and raised in a refugee camp? That's a big question. So, I'm not the only one, and it's not the first time. Not even for me or for any other Palestinian. So this has to stop.
And on that note, and I don't mean to interrupt, but even though I was born here in the United States, I still feel the direct effect of the occupation. Mm-hmm. My family, now when they visit the West Bank, has to visit as a regular tourist and is given a visa once they arrive into Israel, just like any other tourist, and given a limited amount of time that they are allowed to stay there. Why should my parents go and visit as a tourist to a country that they were born in and entitled to, and why should they lose their rights to their land and to their homes and to their property? So it's affected many, many generations, not just the ones who were directly affected in 1948.
Well, let me add something here. Like, honestly, I'm 36 years old now, but I never had a childhood. As I said earlier, I was raised in a refugee camp, and I always, had a question to my family, why we are here? What are we doing here?
Right.
Where's my country? What happened? So that impression or that fact that we live among the years, it really hurts. It's even actually more than what happened 2 weeks ago.
I'll ask you both this question.
Mm-hmm.
With the recent political elections in the United States, Canada, across the world, has the world, in particular the United States, done enough? And do you see change now with the new president in the United States? Let's start with the motion.
Well, I hope so. Let's say that. I'm going to start with saying I hope so. Well, they're always saying there's a change, but it's never exist.
Right.
I just hope for that, but I don't see it coming anytime soon.
Reem?
Well, we know that President Obama has made the Middle East situation a priority in his first week of office, and we commend him on that. As for the United States doing much at the time that this was happening, no, the United States continuously stood by its ally, and not for any justified reason whatsoever other than the fact that Israel is their ally, and continued making excuses on behalf of Israel for killing all these civilians. What happened in Gaza is a war crime. It's an act of terrorism. An act of terrorism is defined as an act of any political or state body, an act of violence that's committed outside the laws of war. And that's exactly what happened in Gaza. It's an illegal act of violence towards innocent people. So what we're hoping happens is that President Obama declares that what Israel has done in Gaza in the recent weeks is a war crime. And hopefully that will allow for Palestinians who have directly suffered, any people in Gaza or any family members that have lost family or suffered or lost their property, to be able to have a claim in court, in the International Criminal Court. Hopefully, if that does happen, if somebody in the United Nations, the United Nations Secretary, Security Council, or U.S. Congress, or the President declares that Israel's act of war is an act of war crime, then that will give someone the right to come into court here in the United States and sue Israel. So we're hoping that a lot more happens, hopefully, and a lot more actions taken.
Let me just point mm-hmm. something out here.
Sure.
Like the American government administration, they always have a double standard about the Middle East conflict. Always. I was hoping for President Barack Obama to make the changes that he promised, but the first double standard that I picked on this issue particularly was, if you remember what happened in India, that terrorist attack was like 2 months ago.
Right.
Or like not even 2 months ago. At that time, Mr. Obama was a president-elect, and Bush was in power still. He did not comment, he did make comment on that terrorist attack in India. So when it comes to Gaza, like 2 weeks after that, he did not say anything. And when they asked him about Gaza to have his opinion, he said, I'm not the president now.
Yeah.
Mr. Bush, he's the one who is responsible to make comments on this. So that's a double standard. Why he has the right as the president-elect to say something about against the terrorist attack in India, but about Gaza's attack from Israel, he did not comment anything.
Our time is up. I really appreciate you both joining me this evening, Remode and Motion Salah. Motion, again, my condolences for the loss of your family. And all we can do is hope and pray that this conflict will see a resolution soon, and we'll talk again. I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. What I wanted to do with that interview is just to show that political expression, freedom of expression, is alive and well here at Scared Monkeys Radio. And, you know, we had Walid Chobat on a few weeks ago, and tonight we have a different opinion. And this, no matter who you are or what you believe in, no one should have their family lost that way. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. All right, I'll cut into that PSA because we had a little bit of a delay contacting my next guest. Bob Peters is the president of Morality in Media. He's a regular, semi-regular guest on the program. We haven't had him on for a little while, but I wanted to bring him on to talk about the Child Online Protection Act. Again, if we can't protect our children, especially online, I'm not sure who we can protect. The Supreme Court, are they going to quash this thing or not? I don't know. Bob Peters, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
What's going on with the Child Online Protection Act and the Supreme Court? This is making me nervous a little bit.
Well, I tell you, my sense of things is that by refusing to hear the appeal in this case, the Supreme Court has finally put to death the Child Online Protection Act, which Congress passed in, I don't remember if it was 1996 or 1997. I think it was 1997 that Congress passed COPPA. And it's been in litigation ever since. And, you know, literally going on, close to 12 years after Congress passed it, the Supreme Court finally allows it to die. And during this whole dozen years, or close to a dozen years, the law has been unenforceable because there have been injunctions issued against it at the district court level. And it just befuddles my mind, because the primary reason the court has refused to uphold this law is this wonderful notion that parental use of filtering technology is an adequate solution to the problem.
No.
And I just don't think that's true. And I don't know whether I should pull my hair out I have to scratch my head in disbelief or pull my hair out in absolute utter frustration at how at least five judges can believe that parental use of screening technology is the whole solution to protecting children from pornography on the Internet. It just defies imagination.
It's just understanding, and they don't understand, the parents don't understand, and when it comes to education, technology, you name it, parents, baby boomers, Gen Xers, whatever you want to call them, are so far behind, in my opinion, they haven't got a clue what's going on, and that's what makes this thing so backwards and so disappointing that these judges have to think that way. What do you think the answer is, though, Bob?
It's a good question. You know, I mean, at one level, the answer is a couple of new judges that have some common sense and aren't ideologically driven. Because I think part of the problem is, you know, whether a judge is coming from a liberal political persuasion or what I would call a radical libertarian persuasion, the outcome is pretty much the same. I remember, I'm not a political science major, but I remember the claim being made that when you get to the extremes of things, there was very little difference between communism and fascism. That they kind of met up someplace out there in Never Never Land. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that when you push the liberal political philosophy or the libertarian political philosophy to the extreme, you pretty much wind up in the same place, at least in some issues. And you've got judges who, in my opinion, are radical liberals and a couple of whom are radical libertarians. And they basically agree with each other on issues like pornography. And it's unfortunate, because effectively what they've done is to rewrite the First Amendment to protect things that I think any honest person would have to conclude the First Amendment was never intended to protect.
Yeah, that's so true. Bob Peters from Morality Media is here. Last time we talked, this current administration was not the current administration. And talk about radical left and ideology on the left, it's here, it's full force. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, that's a good question. I'm kind of hoping Barack Obama, that now that he is the president, if he wants to be the president of all of the American people, which he, I think part of him wants to be.
I think so.
He's not going to be able to push his radical agenda. And certainly part of the radical agenda would be in his selection of judges. But if he, it's an interesting thing. Most people, Thurgood Marshall, who was the first African-American to serve on the Supreme Court. And, I mean, Thurgood Marshall was a courageous man. The civil rights battle was not a battle for cowards. And Thurgood Marshall was at the leaders, one of the leaders in the civil rights movement. He became a Supreme Court justice and was a lion on civil rights issues. But what a lot of people aren't aware of is that Thurgood Marshall also voted to strike down the child pornography laws.
Yeah.
And he was against laws against adult pornography, and he was for stripping. On moral issues, Thurgood Marshall was horrible.
Yeah.
Civil rights issues, he was a great man, but his morality wasn't good at all. And if Barack Obama appoints somebody like Thurgood Marshall, I guess I can retire, because the battle against pornography will be lost.
Yeah, I've seen your picture. I don't know if you got much more hair to pull out, but
I tell you, my wife forces me to keep it short, and I've kind of come to the conclusion she's probably right about that.
Well, Bob, again, when you, and I keep harping on it because that's a lot of the stories that we cover here on my program have to do with the protection of kids and the online predators and all this all this stuff that goes on, the pornography business that's out there, the human trafficking, you name it, the technological aspect of the criminality is huge. And I just don't think, and I hate to say it, that the higher up, Big Brother, if you'd like to call them that, really have a clue what's going on. And maybe it's up to, guys like you and me to try and educate them if they'll listen.
Well, I tell you, they're a hard bunch to teach. One argument that we've made at Morality and Media is that the government, the federal government in particular, wants to focus in on the trafficking problem and the sexual exploitation of children problem. Now, both of those problems are very, very big.
Yeah.
Now, what they've chosen to ignore is the fact that kids aren't just running into predators online, that they're running into pornography online. And there are, the adult obscenity laws could be enforced against 70-80% of these websites that are just offering pornography free of charge and without requiring any age verification. And the other connection is I don't know how you'd put it. Nobody's ever done the definitive study, but there's a lot of evidence that a lot of the men who ultimately start looking for some teenager to have sex with online begin their sexual, I guess you'd call it, odyssey, not by looking at child pornography, but by looking at adult pornography. Right. They get hooked on, and I've actually talked to people, in terms of, I shouldn't say talk, but we've received letters from people, in prison to be specifically, and, they said that, they didn't begin their, the sexual exploitation looking for child pornography. When they first started looking for pornography, they had, quote-unquote, normal sexual desires. But after a while, when they got hooked on pornography, and there's so much teen stuff out there and pseudo-child porn and actual child porn, that at some point they move from adult porn to child porn. And another thing, this is the last thing, there is a whole lot of evidence that a lot of the men who go to prostitutes for sex, in effect what they're doing, it's the only way they can act out their pornography-fueled desires. They can't do it in a marriage, they can't do it with a girlfriend, so they go to prostitutes, which means, in my thinking, that there's a connection between the explosion of pornography and this huge trafficking in women and children problem we've got. But the government basically just refuses to see it.
I don't know.
The FBI and the Justice Department basically have been deaf.
I'm a big consequences kind of guy. I believe that if you commit the crime and the consequences are there, that may be, and I emphasize may be, a way for you not to commit the crime again. Because if you do the crime, you do a long period of time. But it seems like the weak-kneed judges, the weak-kneed politicians, and all of those that are out there, and we seem to be in more of a rehabilitative state than we've ever been before. And I'm not saying that's totally wrong. I'm just saying there's a time and a place for it. But when it comes to this sort of problem, like pornography, predators, the online stuff that's going on, rehabilitation just doesn't work. Slam them in jail, lock the key. That's the only way that maybe it'll help, maybe not. Or am I too far out there, Bob?
Well, I tell you, the Bush, you know, I've had a lot of complaints about what the Bush administration didn't do in this fight against quote-unquote adult pornography, but one thing the Bush administration has done is get much, much tougher on sexual predators.
Yep.
And on child pornography. And interestingly, as the Bush Department, Justice Department, was getting tougher on people who traffic in child pornography, there have been a growing number of complaints from federal judges feeling that the Justice Department is being too hard on people who just, you know, possess or trade or obtain child pornography. You know, they think that these people should be, you know, at one level, I tell you, I mean, part of me sympathizes with these men because I understand at one level how easy it is for a man to get sucked into this stuff, you know? I mean, people don't understand how strong of a hold pornography can become to a person, enough to make the man risk everything. He's, you know, you see some extremely successful people in life being arrested on child pornography charges. I mean, they're willing to risk the world in order to obtain this stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, ought to be an indication to people of how strong a hold it can get on. But, you know, at one level, I sympathize with these men, but if you treat them with kid gloves, then there is no deterrent for others who will do the same thing. And as you put it, if you turn them loose, most of them will go back and do the same thing again because they're addicted to the stuff and they're too weak to beat the addiction. At one level, tragically, the only way we can protect society, protect kids, is, you know, in many, is to put them in jail. And you know, I don't know, with some of this stuff, you know, maybe, you know, they talk about these three strike laws that they developed, I think, in California, maybe other states.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, in some of the crimes that people committed, you know, for, you know, were pretty minor, to put them away for life. But maybe they ought to have a three strike law for people with sexual exploitation of children offenses. And if you get hit the third time, you're going to go away for life.
Yeah.
And that's a sad thing to have to do. But the alternative is to keep turning them loose. And most of them just keep going back to becoming offenders.
And again, if we can't protect the kids, I don't know who we can protect. Bob Peters from Morality in Media. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good night.
It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Yeah, and if we can't protect kids, I don't know who we can protect. And as far as three strikes go, no, with losers like that, one strike and they should be out. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be back in just a minute with ADA out of Los Angeles County, Robin Sachs, and we're going to talk about a ham sandwich. I don't know. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. You know, I talked about it on a commentary the other day, but I almost felt sorry for Greta. And people are going to say, why are you talking about Greta again? She has a big cable TV news show and all this other stuff. But anyway, here, I'll preface this a little bit. Here's Greta. She's talking about the Kaylee and Casey Anthony case. Again, a tragedy. Poor little girl taken from this earth. Mother is in custody. Will be, going to trial on murder charges. All that sort of stuff. George Anthony, the grandfather, some depression, psychiatric issues. Anyway, Greta comes back and she says, she introduces a segment saying that breaking news, and I'm paraphrasing here, breaking news in the Anthony case, and will the whole case hinge on a ham sandwich? And that pricked me up pretty well. I thought, oh God, Greta, what are you doing? It's bad enough that Nancy Grace has Cowboy Leonard on every night to espouse his wisdom, that now she's going to talk about a ham sandwich. So she brings on Mark Furman, and Mark Furman is there, and of course you all know Mark Furman as the super sleuth in the O.J. Simpson case, and she says, what's about the ham sandwich? And Furman has a funny look on his face, and he says, what ham sandwich? And Greta looked panicked, and she says, well, the ham sandwich that has to deal with the Anthony case. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, with all the thousands of people that are missing, all the high-profile cases that need time on these types of shows, they're babbling back and forth about a ham sandwich. Here it boils down to when the contents of Casey Anthony's vehicle were itemized, the Orange County Sheriff's Department log itemization of what was in the vehicle indicated there was cheese. Well, the defense say that there was ham and cheese. So Furman comes back and he says, and I'm going to end up with this in a second, he says, well, there was no ham sandwich, there was ham and cheese. And Greta says, no sandwich? And he says, no, no sandwich. And it became an issue whether or not there was a continuity issue as to whether or not it was just ham or if it was just cheese or both in the vehicle. And I thought, my God, is this what this case has gone to? I thought I'd bring on Robin Sachs, ADA out of Los Angeles County tonight to talk about ham and cheese and other things that are high profile in this case. I couldn't believe it. I'm not sure if you saw it or not, but God, you know, there's got to be other things to talk about than this. And how common is it for maybe an item to be missed? I'm sure it's not a conspiracy of any means if the cheese was missed from the ham from the garbage bag that was pulled out of this car. I can't see that being that important.
Well, I'm cracking up on a number for a number of reasons. The first one is that I, until you just recounted the story, didn't know anything about it, and I thought, oh my God, is there some important thing with ham and cheese in this case that I have no idea, and is, you know, what's going to happen with it? And I guess that's exactly the point. The good news is, and this is my life, and as it is yours, I follow crimes and follow cases all the time, and I'm thrilled to say that this snafu, whatever it is in no way entered anyone's radar in my world, at least in the last couple of days, and I have been talking to my, you know, sleuthers out there. So that's the good news. The bad news is, or not necessarily the bad news, these are exactly the kinds of things that make for wonderful ripe areas of reasonable doubt for those who are really unreasonable. If you and I both were to look in a plastic bag and there was a piece of ham and a piece of cheese, let's just say, I may say there's a piece of ham and a piece of cheese. You may, because you're a ham and cheese sandwich eater, may surmise that to be the ingredients to a ham and cheese sandwich and call it a ham and cheese sandwich. And so it's the same facts could be perceived, you know, a hair different, and both of us could be telling the truth. So I think that this is just, you know, a way to ham it up.
I like that.
Sorry.
Ham it up. Robin Sachs, also one of the stars of the Justice Interrupted radio show on Tuesday nights on Blog Talk Radio, is here. Let's talk about Drew Peterson and Drew Peterson's love life. Joel Brodsky, who you know and I know, he's a man with very little hair anymore. And I imagine when Drew Peterson got on, I think it was Nightline or Dateline or some line, or I don't know what these late night to news shows are called anymore, and started talking, Joel probably pulled the rest of the hair that he had in his head out. After that, the so-called fiance or person that was living with Drew leaves. There's a big news story, police cars, all sorts of stuff. Drew says himself, I wouldn't trust me. And again, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that's in essence what he said. What is Drew Peterson doing to himself, his case, and his lawyer?
Well, I mean, gosh, what doesn't he do that just seems stupid at any given time? Anybody, frankly, the fact that, you know, Drew Peterson even had a fiance during this whole debacle is frightening, although we do hear about all those cases of women, you know, following and fawning themselves after people like this. But the thing that I find that's even more interesting than perhaps the, you know, in and out of this you know, next girlfriend, which is interesting, or with this girlfriend, is the Blagojevich kind of background to it. And I don't know if you know this, but that the PR people who are working on the Blagojevich case are the same PR people that advised Drew Peterson. And you can see that both of those people and both of those, you know, personas in terms of the public figure have the same narcissistic quality, thus making their attorneys crazy for Blagojevich. His attorney actually quit. It's only a matter of time, I would hope, except I don't know if Joel could handle missing the entertainment even in his own life for Mr. Peterson in some way. but they just are their own train wreck, frankly.
You know, my friend and frequent guest on the program, Clint Van Zandt, wrote an article called Drew Peterson, Blagojevich, and Henry VIII. You know, it reminds me of the old Johnny Carson Karnak routine where he'd say Drew Peterson, Blago, and Henry VIII. And what's comparable about the three of them, and I think you just nailed that on the head, but it just seems like I think the grand jury has been going for a year in this case, in the Peterson case. The DAs keep coming out and saying, you know, anytime. And, you know, we have to use the term allegedly in cases like this. At least I try to as much as I can on my program. But when the crap hits the fan, so to speak, in this case, if it does, and it probably will, boy, isn't that going to be something. All the networks are going to be falling over themselves to cover it. But Drew Peterson has done a pretty good job of covering himself, and I don't mean in a good way, or is that just my opinion?
No, that's exactly right, and that's exactly the issue, is that these statements, I mean, we saw it at another Peterson, and that was Scott Peterson, where, yep, you know, what he said out in the media on his own, where he wasn't being pressured by law enforcement, were, you know, critical moments where certain statements could be analyzed in certain ways. Other cases, we know that we look back to media clippings and so forth and decide whether we're going to introduce those or not. And there are bundles and bundles and bundles of tapes to go through that even if you're not the network assigned to cover the case or allowed into the courtroom in the case, you're certainly going to be the network that's going to be able to sell all of those, the footage from the prior interviews.
Robin Sachs is here. Something else that's come up that's burned my fanny a little bit is Jose Baez. And you know, I understand the system as well as anyone. I know defense lawyers have a place, and no matter what they do, we did. You were on the show that we did with the high profile defense lawyers, but Baez is trying to go after Tim Miller in Texas EquiSearch. Tim Miller is the salt of the earth. You can't find a better person nor his organization for records of the searchers. Several thousand, and making an issue. I believe a motion was made in court, and I'm not sure if it's been ruled on. I don't think yet. But what's, you know, again, is it just a way for Baez to find some reasonable doubt? Is he going to have Tim Miller do several thousand dollars worth of photocopying and then never come and get the papers, or what? What's he doing here? I think he's just farting in a windstorm, for lack of a better term.
Right. Well, you know, Baez has been doing a few things that I've been finding less than admirable in the last couple of weeks. It started with the proclamation that the, you know, accusations of Mr. Baez come from the fact that he's Hispanic. When he came out and said that, I almost fell out of my chair. I thought, oh my God, he's now trying to play the race card. I mean, this is a classic example of toss it against the wall and see what will stick. And it's going to be everybody and anyone that he can throw, you know, stuff in the air, and it's going to be, you know, rousing up Tim Miller. It's going to be making him do whatever. So maybe there's one tiny little minutia of detail that he's going to, you know, try to blow up into something huge. It's just ridiculous. And frankly, what he should be doing in my mind, and what he should have been doing from the beginning, is he should be setting up a psychological defense instead of trying to poke at the weaknesses that may be in the prosecution's case, because that theory is not going to work.
Speaking of psychological issues, George Anthony, Grandpa, all of a sudden has a problem. Apparent suicide attempt, on and on and on. I've talked to George Anthony. He and I spent some time on the telephone, although I never interviewed him on air. I interviewed Cindy several times. George seemed like a nice guy, a guy that was going through hell. tell whether or not there's any complicity in his involvement or not. You have to look at this case now and look at it two different ways. All of a sudden, George Anthony, maybe because of what he was doing in his active depression, took some of the heat off of his daughter in the media for a little while, or this is truly a guy who's just had enough.
I don't know. Out of all of the people in the Anthony family, I always have had my eye on George Anthony. There's something that's always bothered me in terms of the fact that he's in law enforcement and that he even, by association, stands next to Cindy, frankly, because I think that Cindy, as the grandmother, as the mother, has been atrocious. And George, while not having said that much and at least testified rather honestly, or what we think to be honestly, in front of the grand jury, in terms of saying that he can't even rule his own daughter out. I just don't see this as something being feigned. I mean, that's just all I'm thinking is it's about time. If you're George Anthony, wouldn't you start to have a psychological breakdown knowing what you know and having to live in this matriarchal home with these crazy women?
Yeah, without being disrespectful, they would have taken me out and thrown me in a rubber room long ago if it was me.
I can't really hold it against the guy. I mean, it's only amazing that something didn't happen sooner. The only thing that I find atrocious is whose decision was it to publicize that information? I'd be curious to know if that was a defense move to garner sympathy.
Yeah, you know, when I heard that and some of the parts of the suicide note, that just burned my butt at all. In fact, my butt's been burned so much as last week I haven't been able to sit down. So anyway, isn't that a scary thought to end the interview on? Robin Sachs, is always a pleasure.
I love it. Don't sit too long.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's ADA Robin Sachs out of Los Angeles County. We're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with Jackie Hollander. She's got an update. She was in court in South Carolina about that James Brown trust issue. We're talking about a couple of $100 million and where it's supposed to go. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. I thought I'd bring on Jackie Hollander with an update. She was in court in South Carolina regarding a motion or a court hearing regarding the James Brown Trust. We've had Jackie on air before talking about the trust and how the money is supposed to go to the kids. And Jackie is back from South Carolina. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Exhausted.
How was the court hearing? I've seen some video, some news video about it. So what happened?
It was pretty rough down there. Mm-hmm. It took 2 days to get down there, and I'm appalled. I'm appalled at what's going on. I have a lawyer down there named Jack Batson, mm-hmm. who is very good. I was taken back to the judge's chamber. I spoke with the judge in private probably for about 10 minutes. And then I went back into the courtroom. I can't say what was discussed.
Sure, I understand.
Behind the judge's doors. I do have standing in the case, which is a major, a major victory for us. I'd like to ask your viewers a question, and I hope that they'll answer this, and maybe you can answer me.
Sure.
Does a black man have a right to write a will in the state of South Carolina?
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You think so?
Yeah. Well, I can see where this is going here right now, and should have or do they have are, I guess, two different things.
I sat in that courtroom, and I watched the Attorney General's office claim different.
Really?
It was absolutely disgusting that six grown children, and I was there watching them, and of course they were, I'm sure you know that there were daggers. I had to leave town under death threats,
mm-hmm.
Which was not a real good situation.
No.
But I sat there, and this all boils down to the fact that a trust which I created,
mm-hmm.
back in 1987, that six, the children of James Brown adults at that believe that, even if they are left out of the will, that they deserve money. That the poor and the needy do not deserve money. And Tommy Rae Heine, who claims to be the wife, but was never married, feels she should have money. You know, and this is all about, you know, mansions and furs and diamond rings and a lifestyle that they were left out of the will. The state of South Carolina Attorney General believes that he should rewrite the will and give half of that money to these people. And, you know, I have to be back in court on February 16th. Because I was there, I stopped the settlement, which was supposed to go down the other day.
Right.
So I threw the wrench into it and stopped it.
And that's
Thank
good.
God.
That's good.
Are you there?
I'm here.
But basically, what South Carolina is saying is that this will, they want to change. The only thing in the will was everything in that will was left 100% to the I Feel Good Children's Trust Fund. Everything. And it was left for the poor, and it was left for the needy. It was left for the sick, and it was left for those to get an education. 2 years of people that were not left in the will, and not one penny to one deserving sick or needed child has received one penny. And I have a real problem with this.
Yeah.
Because when I created this, its purpose was for the poor. And I sat in there, Dana, and I looked at a room full of bloodsuckers. A room full of them. I mean, people that just could care less about the poor and the needy. And I think South Carolina, from the Attorney General's office all the way down to even the judge, should have stopped this.
Yep.
This should not have gone on for 2 years.
What's going to happen on the 16th, Jackie?
Well, I mean, you know, when I left out of there, it was left that there was going to be another hearing. Obviously, I'm going to have to take the stand.
Yep.
Obviously, I'm going to have to release tapes. I went down there with probably 7 good boxes full of video footage, tapes. And, of course, I was told that, you know, I need to hold them until the next hearing. And I guess I'll take the stand, and we will release to the media and to the courtroom the truth in his own words. I mean, a will obviously is not enough. A will is not enough, and I need to say this because it really has bugged me. The Constitution of the United States gives us the right to freedom of speech. It also gives us the right to write what we feel, just as journalists write stories about people. And you, Dana, interview people and allow them to have their say. If this judge says, I will not accept a written will, I don't want this will the way it is, I want to change it, then they are treading on the Constitution of the United States, and the next person that dies and writes a will have lost that right. So these are issues. Yes, this is the person that raped me. Yes, I have a serious problem with this. But I also created this trust, and I have a responsibility to see to it that every penny goes to the poor, the needy, and those that are deserving of it.
And that's, you know, again, we've talked about it before. Your strength is, it can't be measured, Jackie. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll stay in touch. I'm out of time around the 16th and find out what's going on next. You take care and stay safe, please.
Well, gee, Dana, please travel with me down there.
I wished I could.
By phone.
Well, maybe we can arrange that. Absolutely.
Thank you, Dana.
We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Jackie Hollander with an update on the James Brown Trust. Well, that's it. That's tonight's program. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up past shows on podcast, listen to daily commentaries, leave comments, make chicken soup, do whatever you would like to do there. Make sure to check out the creme de la creme of blogs, scaredmonkeys.com. There you will find everything you wanted to know about blogging, the news, and it hasn't been hermetically sealed on Funkin' Wagnall's porch either. Maybe I'm dating myself a bit. Thank you all. Good night, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.